please rise. Court is now in session, please be seated.
Good afternoon. The court's ready to hear argument in Carr versus Shocker. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Walt Smith on behalf of Anita Carr. There are essentially two issues presented in this appeal. The first of which is factual and involves the construction of the medical testimony in this case. Somewhat unusually, there is but a single doctor who testified at the most recent board hearing, so there really isn't a dispute among doctors that may more frequently be seen in these cases. And the question is essentially what his testimony means. Dr. Speaker began...
Can you be more specific?
Yes, certainly, absolutely. Dr. Speaker testified in an earlier hearing in preparation for an August 2001 hearing before the board that he had seen Ms. Carr repeatedly. There have been numerous evaluations with Dr. Speaker in this case. In June of 2001, at his deposition before the first board hearing, Dr. Speaker indicated that she should have sedentary to light duty restrictions that are consistent with activities of daily living. He also specified that those should be in a part-time capacity and she should not be bending, twisting, or stooping as a result of her work injury. As early as June of 2001, Dr. Speaker specified that those restrictions were expected to be permanent. He did not think that they would improve over time. At that point in time, Dr. Speaker specified in terms of the part-time restrictions, he said 4 to 6 hours a day, 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on again, and then the weekend off. Procedurally, the board terminated Ms. Carr's benefits following that hearing. We went to the Superior Court, and the Superior Court determined that with those work restrictions, her residual capabilities, her other vocational qualifications, she was, in fact, prima facie displaced. This is not only an application of the displaced worker doctrine, it's an application of the displaced worker doctrine that doesn't even get to the availability of employment within the general labor market or the claimant's effort at obtaining employment within the general labor market.
You were going to tell us what the factual issue was. What is it?
The factual issue is how we construe Dr. Speaker's opinion on work restrictions, more specifically whether it's changed between 2001 and 2003.
Whether what has changed?
His opinion. If his opinion is the same before as it is now, the question becomes what has changed sufficient to change the claimant's status as a prima facie displaced worker from 2002 to 2004.
I thought the factual issue, you can correct me if I had that wrong, is whether there has been a change in her medical condition. Is that the issue?
There is. I think we're just expressing it differently. The medical condition is described solely by Dr. Speaker in this case because he's the only doctor who testified at the most recent board decision. He testified more than once, so the question is what happened over time and has it changed from the earlier hearing to the subsequent hearing?
And what is your position on
my
that?
My position is that there's been no change. In fact, to quote Dr. Speaker directly, he said in his February 2003 deposition, he was asked, I assume that the work restrictions have been exactly the same all the way through for the last couple of years. Is that right? He says in answer, quote, again, I've always specified that I thought activities of daily living should reflect what her employment restrictions should be.
Isn't the focus in the opinions on appeal, though, what his initial opinion said she should have a day off, and then his subsequent opinion said she could work a few hours every day without a day off in between?
I think the first question is exactly addressed to that point, and it is whether that represents a material change in her restrictions.
Exactly. The aggregate number of hours aren't that different, but what he did say is you no longer need a day of rest in between.
True. Although his opinion is a little bit inconsistent in that regard, in that he said just what you've indicated, and at the same time he says, my opinion's always been the same, the quote that I just read.
Well, I think what the court's looking for is a sharp focus on what, if any, factual disputes you contend are in the record, or what you think the facts are, or pick the facts in the light most favorable to your opponent, and then tell us the issue of law that constitutes reversible error.
Very well. It's our position that factually there's been no change in work restrictions. Dr. Speaker meant what he said when he said there's been no change over time. It's been the same for years. As a result of that, and in connection with the President Judge, now Justice Ridgely's opinion that she is a prima facie displaced worker in 2002, the legal question becomes, why has that changed? Why is it that if she was prima facie displaced in 2002 based on the same work restrictions, there's been no change in the work restrictions.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm getting very confused here. I thought that the change was not in the number of hours per week that she would be eligible to work or capable of working, but rather that as opposed to working day on, day off type thing, the doctor later determined or opined that she could work half days or 4-hour days, whatever, 5 days a week, and that with that change in how she could accommodate her hours during the week, it opened up job possibilities that were not available if she was working one day on, one day off. And that's the full explanation for the differences. Am I missing something?
Well, I think that characterizes the factual dispute, but it I think gets us away from the second legal issue.
Doesn't it define the legal issue, though? If, as you argue, there has been no change in Ms. Carr's medical condition, but there has been a change in the job market between the two hearings. That is, the job market became more favorable once you take the same number of hours and spread them out differently. Isn't the issue whether that change in the job market is sufficient without a change in the medical condition to remove Ms. Carr from the status of being a displaced worker?
Your Honor, I think that may be actually a separate question that I'm happy to address. And the reason I say it may be separate is that I think you're suggesting an extrinsic change, that is, the job market, rather than the intrinsic change of the restrictions on the claimant herself. Hawks versus Radisson says changes in the job market, and in fact, this court.
I am suggesting that may be an issue in the case. Yes, and I'm asking you whether it is. That is, if there has to be, as a legal matter, a change in the claimant's medical condition, then the primary issue is whether there was. If that's not the only factor that can displace a prima facie displaced worker, or I should say replace, then you get to the change in the job market, don't you? I mean, those are the only two variables.
Well, I think that displaced worker, there are sort of two parts to the displaced worker analysis under Franklin Fabricators. The first part is the so-called prima facie displaced worker analysis. And that's an analysis that takes place before you get to the nature of the availability of work in the job market. And it considers the factors, status, this is a quote from Franklin Fabricators versus Irwin. Prima facie displaced worker requires consideration of the claimant's degree of obvious physical impairment coupled with other factors such as the injured employee's mental capacity, education, training, or age. Those are all intrinsic to the claimant. And
do you mean by that medical condition?
No, I mean vocational qualification for work, which includes medical condition, includes, for example, how much education they have and whether they're qualified only for factory work or would be well-suited to an office position, how old they are and whether they're likely to be employed in the general labor market where they have age-related difficulties getting back to work.
Well, I think what we're focusing on, at least what I'm focusing on, is this sentence in the Superior Court's opinion. It's the bottom of 11 over to 12.
Which opinion? Earlier or the later?
In the April 29th, 2004 opinion. And the sentence says, the board heard evidence of an increased number of jobs suitable for the claimant due to the different work restrictions, and no evidence from the claimant to show that she cannot be employed due to her disability.
It's our position that going back to the Superior Court's 2002 decision, she's found to be a prima facie displaced worker, and the court ruled, and I would quote from Judge Ridgely's opinion in that case, the evidence portrays a person disqualified from regular employment in any well-known branch of the competitive labor market for whom a job must be specially created if she is to be steadily employed.
Wait a second. Didn't that depend at least in part on the fact that she could only work, she was told that she could only work every other day, and now that's changed?
It depends on her work restrictions. It doesn't depend on that particular analysis doesn't depend on the availability of jobs in the labor market. We don't get to that question, and the reason you decide the prima facie displaced worker question first is depending on how that's resolved controls whose burden of proof it is in terms of whether the claimant has to establish that she's looked for work or the employer has to establish that there's work available for the claimant in ultimately determining whether the claimant is displaced. But a prima facie displaced worker finding is preliminary to that. And given that a finding that you're prima facie displaced means by definition that you need a specially created job if you're going to be steadily employed, the question then becomes, what's changed to get us away from that? And the first question is, did the work restrictions change? So your point is well taken on that. It's our position that by Dr. Speaker's own admission, the restrictions really haven't changed. That we've gone from 2 days on, 1 day off, the hours aggregate to approximately the same. Is this any different from saying...
Well, wait a second. From the doctor's perspective, he may be saying, hey, I said that she could work 20 hours a week. I said that before. I'm saying it now. But saying it in one form, namely a few days on, a few days off, or saying it as 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, apparently makes a huge difference in whether there is work out there or whether a job would have to be specially created to meet her needs. Why isn't that the definitive change that took place?
The reason that Dr. Speaker says it isn't any different. I don't think a fair reading of both of his depositions, testimonies for both of the board's hearings, would reveal that it was really any different. He said her physical condition has been the same, she's examined the same, the whole thing has been the same all the way through. Is it just a matter of getting the doctor to just adjust the work restrictions at an absolutely modest amount in order to bring us back before the board and to invalidate a prior finding that the claimant is prima facie displaced? Should it be easy enough to be a matter of semantics and how modest the change is enough? This is so modest that not even Dr. Speaker thinks it's significant, and that's the part that's so troubling about it from the claimant's perspective.
Let's focus, to use Justice Holland's term. You're arguing that the Superior Court and the board erred as a matter of law, correct?
Yes.
Tell us precisely in what respect or respects the board and the Superior Court erred as a matter of law.
The error as a matter of law is not finding the claimant, not continuing the claimant's prima facie displaced worker status and applying the burden that now Justice Ridgely articulated in 2002 when he said this claimant is prima facie displaced. She's going to need a specially created job if she is to be steadily employed. Now, that legal conclusion necessarily depends on the fact that there's been no change in her work restrictions.
I'm sorry. Tell us again, what is the legal error?
The legal error is that the board and the Superior Court did not impose on the employer this specially created job if she is to be steadily employed. They didn't impose... Let me try to express it this way. We started from the beginning in the second hearing in this case before the Industrial Accident Board. Rather than starting where we already were when we finished the first appeal and got the decision from Judge Ridgely in 2002, that of her...
Are you saying that the burden should have been on the employer to overcome the initial finding of a displaced worker status?
Of a prima facie displaced worker status,
yes.
Which I would suggest is more substantial than an ordinary displaced worker.
No. Are you saying that the burden was shifted to the plaintiff to negate that? That is, that the burden should have been on the employer, but as a practical matter, was placed on the claimant? What are you arguing about burden?
Yes, exactly.
And spell that out.
If she's a prima facie displaced worker, the burden is on the employer to prove the availability of work. And in fact, to look at that language from Judge Ridgely, it's not just the availability of work, but we've specifically found in 2002 that she needs a specially created job.
And my question is not intended to be rhetorical. I'm sincerely interested in your answer. And you say the burden was on the employer. Your opponent reads the record as follows. The burden was on the employer, and the employer came in and basically said, now that we have this different opinion from Dr. Speaker, in the employer's words, we have a situation analogous to people who share a job. Some people work in the morning, some people work in the afternoon. This person is now able to work 4 hours a day. She can share a job, she can work part-time. Therefore, we no longer have to specially create a job. Her status has changed. Isn't that basically what they were arguing?
That is what they were arguing. Yes, sir.
And so why is that contradicted by the record?
Because Dr. Speaker doesn't think that anything has changed. He said that his opinion has been consistent from the get-go. It's been the same for 4 years and six visits.
If Dr. Speaker, in the first hearing, had suggested that the 20 hours a week or whatever be allocated in the way that he suggested in the second hearing, would that have met the burden of the employer?
I'm not sure I understand the justice's question. Can you say it again?
Well, in the first hearing, that is, the hearing is the result of which there was a reversal by the Superior Court, testimony was that she was restricted to a day on and a day off for 4 days. On the second hearing, basically the only change was that there would be continuous work, that is, working, you know, each day for part-time rather than taking one day on and one day off. If that second scenario had been presented to the board the first time, would that have been sufficient?
Would that have met
the burden?
Would we have had a reversal to begin with? Is that your question?
Yes.
I would suggest that Judge Ridgely's 2002 decision should have been applicable to that as well, because in that case we had a complete failure of labor market survey evidence.
Is your answer no?
I believe that there would have been a reversal in that case, yes.
That is, even if the working every day for 4 days but only part-time, only part-days had been presented as the restriction, that would have called for a reversal the first time around.
I thought your question was if the restrictions had been 4 hours, 5 days at the first hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that would have called for a reversal as well.
And the reason being?
There was no labor market survey evidence in the first hearing that was sufficient. I think it requires, your hypothetical requires some assumptions, because a lot of the problem with labor market survey in that case was premised on the work restrictions. I still think it was defective in the initial hearing, and that reversal still would have been appropriate.
Well, let me modify Justice Jacobs' question a little bit. Let's assume that at the first hearing, all the evidence about the labor market and what jobs would be available that was presented in the second hearing was actually presented in the first hearing, and the medical testimony was that she could work the half day. At that point, would the board's decision have been appropriately affirmed or reversed?
I think that there are problems with the board's decision and the application of the labor market survey that we haven't really gotten to, in the sense that to what extent, for example, this teaching position that's been articulated, substitute teaching, and the extent to which that's available on a regular basis and whether that constitutes the availability of regular employment as opposed to sporadic employment, I think there are still issues there that make it very troubling to terminate the claimant's benefits on the availability of that kind of part-time work.
Mr. Smith, you have stopped the clock, so you have about a minute and 15 seconds for rebuttal.
I appreciate the court's kindness. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Klusman, and I represent the State of Delaware and the Stokely Center in this case. I believe the claimant's, or the appellant, position in this case comes down to one question, and that question is whether there is sufficient evidence in the record to support a change in the claimant's physical condition so that she is no longer a displaced worker.
Do you concede that there has to be a showing of a change in the claimant's physical or medical condition as between hearing one and hearing two?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I believe that there does need to be some change.
It isn't enough to have simply a change in the job market, but no change in the claimant's medical condition.
It has been my position in the past, and it continues to be my position, that a change in the job market is also sufficient. And I think, Your Honor, I refer to a case in my briefs, I think it's the Dickerson case or Dickinson case, in which the Industrial Accident Board, it didn't go above the board level, but in that case, there was a termination petition that was granted because the employer did show simply a change in the job market, not a change in the claimant's physical condition.
But in this case, you're predicating the state's position on a change in the medical condition, even though that wasn't legally required.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So the issue then, as you see it, is a factual one.
It is.
Well, it appears that Dr. Speaker could have done one of two things. So tell me which of the two he did, and then tell the court where to find it in the record. The first thing he could have done is said, I've examined the claimant again, and she's exactly the same. But now that I've had some time to think about it, I don't really think she needs a day of rest between job assignments. She can work every day for 4 hours a day. So he says, unequivocally, nothing's changed except I've changed my mind. The other thing he could have said was, I examined the claimant again, and it appears that her condition has stabilized, or she seems to be doing a lot of things around the house that she's relating to me as far as her history and physical. And as a result of what she's telling me in her history and physical about what she's able to do, I think she's improved. And I think she can now work 4 hours a day without a day of rest. So which did he do in this case?
Your Honor, I think he does both. I don't think he comes right out and says he does both. But I think the implication is if the doctor says this lady can work part-time, sedentary to light duty work, but needs to work 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, and then the weekend off.
That's his first opinion.
That's his first opinion. And he clearly says she needs a day to rest and recover after the second day. He says she can't work more than, I think he kind of confuses the issue because he says she can't work more than 48 hours straight without requiring a break. And what he meant by that is two shifts, two different days.
Well, my question really is, why did he change his mind that she did not need the day of rest? Where do we find something in the record we can read that says, I've concluded she no longer needs a day of rest because?
I think there are a couple of issues that address that point. And I think we've already covered, there are 4 points that I wanted to make to Your Honors this morning. You've covered certainly adequately the first one, which was the change of Dr. Speaker that I think is sufficient in and of itself, his language that she can now work 4 hours a day.
And I want you to make all four of your points. But right now that I have you interrupted, I want you to tell me where in the appendix, where in somebody's brief, I can find why Dr. Speaker changed his mind so that I can read it.
Well, if I had to go through that, and I do have some points marked off here, if I had to go through this second deposition, and that's the one you'd have to focus on, he says, for instance, on page 15, that I believe, this is line 12, page 15.
And where in the appendix?
Your Honor, I don't have the appendix in front of me, but these transcripts should all have come up to the court.
They do.
The process.
All the transcripts are filed in the room behind that wall. And the only thing the justices have in their chambers are the appendix.
Okay. I don't know where this is in the appendix.
Okay.
It was my understanding that all the deposition transcripts from the board level would be sent up as part of the record.
Well, but it's impossible for the court to distribute five copies of the entire record in any case to all five of the justices, and that's why in the rules of the Supreme Court it specifically says if there's any part of the record that supports your position, you need to identify it and put it in your appendix.
The transcript of the hearing itself, I believe, was attached either to Mr. Schmittinger's brief or to my answering brief, but probably to his. And these portions of the deposition were all read into the record.
I'm not trying to be difficult.
I understand.
We've got about six or eight cases a week that we have to read, and this is your only case.
Yes.
It's helpful to ask if the lawyers help us get into their case. And we just need citations in an appendix because it's impossible for us to read the entire record in eight cases every week.
Understood.
Which is why we have an appendix.
Understood.
All right, well, tell us what you're reading, and then you can...
What I am reading is, for instance, this is just an example, on page 15 of the transcript of the second deposition, February of 03, line 12, the doctor says, I believe I testified she could drive a vehicle at this point. He also says that she does not require an assistive device as of his last exam, meaning the cane. At the first deposition, he said she required a quad cane. And when she used the quad cane, her lifting limitations were changed. They went from 10 to 15 pounds, which is typical sedentary, down to 5 to 7.5 pounds. And the board, in its first decision, found that she required the quad cane all the time. So she couldn't drive at the time of the first deposition. She couldn't drive, and she told the board she couldn't drive as a result of a combination of her medications and her pain. She couldn't drive, and she testified at the first hearing. She did not testify at the second hearing, so I don't know what she would have said. But she couldn't drive because of the pain and the meds. She needed to use the cane, which reduced her lifting restriction by half, or increased her lifting restriction by half, by 50%.
Is there anywhere in the record that you're familiar with where he said why she no longer needed a day of rest?
No, Your Honor. It is not. It wasn't even brought up by me on direct. It was brought up by Mr. Schmittinger on cross-examination of Dr. Speaker.
What wasn't brought up by you on direct?
The fact that there was a change in her condition from
a change
from
in her medical
the unusual to the standard 4 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Why not?
Because he said it, and I didn't explore further why he said it. Because it was clear to me that there were other changes in her physical condition. It was fairly obvious to me that there was a change in her physical condition. When you look at these other factors, the fact that she could drive now, the fact that she didn't need a cane anymore, the fact that she told Dr. Speaker she was now out looking for work herself. She said she was looking for work as a substitute teacher. And she never had done that before.
The first set of examinations by Dr. Speaker, which resulted in his findings that there were more restrictions, took place when?
Took place in 2001.
Do you have a month?
You're talking about the examinations themselves?
That's correct.
The deposition was in June of 01. I'm not sure if I can put my finger on the exact date of the exam without getting into my file, Your Honor.
Well, I'm going to ask you.
I have November of 2000.
Of 2000.
I believe was his last exam.
And the second examination or round of examinations?
Well, the second round of examinations would have been three times she was examined in 2002, February, August, and December of 2002.
And that spanned the issuance of the second of the remand decision, correct?
Yes. Yes, it did. So I think, Your Honor, the court appears to have a wonderful grasp of the issue. But it's my opinion that that this issue is not limited to the fact that Dr. Speaker said the claimant could work 4 hours a day, 5 days a week during the second deposition. You also have to look at the fact that she didn't need the cane anymore. She could drive. She testified at the first hearing that her day was spent in bed or on a recliner at home. That was her day. During Dr. Speaker's second deposition, he testified that when I examined her, there wasn't a thing at home that she told me she couldn't do. And you'll notice that when the board puts all this into its decision, they reference the fact that she could clean the house, she could make the bed, she could cook her meals. I mean, she was completely self-sufficient at the time of the second hearing when Dr. Speaker saw her during the second rounds of his examinations. She was a completely different person. She wasn't restricted to the recliner or the bed anymore. She didn't need the cane. She could drive. So there's much more to this case than simply Dr. Speaker's one statement. Now, I'd also like to bring to your attention the fact that when Mr. Schmittinger Sr. argued this case before the board at the first hearing, he said, and this is on the bottom of page 5, he said, at most, she can work 4 to 6 hours per day doing sedentary to light work. She can lift up to 10 pounds, occasionally lift 15 pounds. She can only do that 2 days in a row before she needs a day off from work. In other words, she can't work consecutive part-time days, so she can work 4 to 6 hours, 2 days on and a day off. That's just an example of the fact that at the time of the first hearing, the claimant, the appellant up here, before Your Honor, made a lot of the fact that the claimant was restricted to that unusual part-time schedule. And we get up to this court, and all of a sudden, the argument is that we're talking about semantics. The opening and the reply brief filed by the appellant are asking you to dismiss that difference because we're arguing about semantics. But before the board, back in 2001, it wasn't semantics. That was the crux of his argument. There was an attempt to try to make it seem like I, on behalf of the employer, couldn't support the termination petition because I couldn't find any employers that would offer jobs to this lady 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on. And he was right. So to argue before this court that that's semantics is a real reversal of a position at this point, if you ask me. Finally, Your Honor, I just want to bring up again the fact that the claimant did not appear at the second hearing at all, didn't present any evidence on her own behalf. Certainly could have testified herself that her condition hadn't changed, that she either couldn't drive or needed the cane or couldn't work more than 2 days at a time. She didn't do that. And she also didn't submit any medical testimony on her own behalf.
I note that then President Judge Ridgely, in his opinion, did cite the fact that the claimant no longer had to use a cane, but I don't see any mention of driving.
Your Honor, the board did in its second decision, and I'm not sure that Judge Ridgely did or not. In the second board decision, dated March of 2003, on page 3, it indicates, claimant does not require the use of an assistive device and is capable of driving a vehicle, which was different than before. Then on page 4, the board's decision says, claimant fulfills the duties of running her household, including making the beds, preparing food, and cleaning. She never indicated to Dr. Speaker that there is one activity that she cannot do around the house, which is completely different than what she said before. Completely, totally different. And she could have rebutted these presumptions or these statements from Dr. Speaker by appearing and testifying on her own behalf. Thank you.
Thank you.
Given the short time that we have here, I would suggest that the record does not support that the claimant was a completely different person at the time of the second hearing. Dr. Speaker is the only medical evidence that there is, and his opinion is entirely consistent over the course of 5 visits. The other thing I'd like to point out, and in response to Justice Holland's question about what exactly Dr. Speaker's opinion was, did he just change his mind or was there something different here? It occurs to me that it may be both. I mean, it may be a matter of the claimant could do a multitude of work restrictions that are somewhat variable, whether it's 6 hours times 2 days and a day off and 2 more 6-hour days, or it's 4 5-hour days, or it's 7 2-hour days. Maybe all of those would be okay and consistent with her abilities, and yet different. And underlying those different work restrictions is absolutely no change in her physical condition. It may be, in that sense, that there are a multitude of constructions of the work restrictions at any point in time that may be appropriate. And yet, there's nothing that's changed here. She's still a prima facie displaced worker, and it's still the employer's burden of proof.
Thank you. And thank you both very much. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.